So welcome everyone, and I've been inviting people to take a copy of the survey that is over on the white music stand. We're going to be coming back to that a little bit later, but my name's Pastor Dave Carlson. I'm from Duluth, Minnesota, and we're going to be looking at Earth Stewardship and the Missio Dei in three sessions. But first, I'd like for us to open up with a word of prayer. So I invite you to pray the words with me. These come from the LBW. And let us pray. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, maker of all things. Through your goodness, you have blessed us with these gifts. With them, we offer ourselves to your service and dedicate our lives to the care and redemption of all that you have made, for the sake of him who gave himself for us, Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. The care and redemption of all you have made is a subtitle of the Doctor of Ministry thesis that I wrote in 2016. And the care and redemption of all God has made is our topic this week, too. We're going to look at Earth stewardship from three perspectives: theoretical, biblical, and theological. Throughout the week, I'll refer to my Doctor of Ministry thesis that is also available at the bookstore, and it's in paperback version that you can pick up. We'll unpack these main themes as well as some of the results that I did from a survey of Lutheran congregations and leaders. One of my main assumptions is that a congregation is an ideal setting for modeling the kind of earth stewardship needed for a more sustainable world. And one of my main findings is that congregations that have intentional creation care teams or green teams have a greater capacity to integrate earth stewardship into the whole life of their congregations, to make adaptive changes and grow in their missional relationships in their communities. Quick show of hands, how many of your congregations already have a creation care team or a green team? Okay, that's great. How many of you are thinking of having? If you are, I want to make sure that everyone here has an idea of how to start one or ways in which you can strengthen your already existing green teams. Creation care teams help integrate earth stewardship in five different areas. Our sessions are going to talk about these: worship, education, congregational life, building and grounds, and community action. These categories come from David Rhodes, a professor from LSTC, and they're found at LutheransRestoringCreation.org. So if your congregation doesn't have a creation care team, I want to help you leave here with an idea of how to start one. But first, let's go back to that term, Missio Dei. It's a Latin term, literally meaning the mission of God, or God's mission. In the ELCA, Directors of Evangelical Mission, one in each of our synods, know this term, and it's connected to what they and others call the missional church, if that rings a bell. How congregations are rediscovering their identity and as being centers of God's mission. Here, the triune God is creating, redeeming, inspiring, and sending the church to discern and participate with what God is doing for the sake of the whole world. The center focus is on God and God's action, so that missional theologians say that the church doesn't have a mission, but rather God's mission has a church. And bishops are asking congregations to develop mission plans, asking, what is God up to? And then how can we participate in what God is doing in the world? One of the areas that we could point to is earth stewardship. Amid the widespread systemic problems of the ecological crisis, surely God is calling for adaptive changes not only in society, but also in the church, especially if we are to provide faithful leadership in addressing them. And yet the well-being of all creation does not yet seem integral to this missional movement. There's a disconnect between earth stewardship and in theology and in practice. There's even a tendency to overlook earth stewardship as being part of God's mission, part of the purpose of the church. Consider this observation from Craig Van Gelder and Dwight Shiley of Luther Seminary regarding the missional conversation. It's striking, they say, how little theological attention is paid to creation when talking about mission. And again, missional theology begs for a robust understanding of creation and culture existing within the life of the Trinity and as integral to God's missionary ends for bringing the whole cosmos to fulfillment. While that call may be beyond the scope of my D-Min thesis, my literature review pointed to several interpretive lenses that I think can bridge missional and ecological conversations. And these are the lenses that we're going to highlight in these three sessions. The concern with each lens is how it helps us think holistically about Earth's stewardship. That is, not as one ministry among many, but as integral to all aspects of ministry. So we're going to think about how Earth stewardship can be integrated into all aspects of church life. The first three lenses from environmental and social sciences take seriously the contextual nature of the ecological crisis and how the church contributes to and might act to remedy it. So we're going to look at sustainability, globalization, and global civil society today. Sustainability. If we view the Earth as an interdependent system of geological and biological processes on which human society depends, then sustainability is ensuring the welfare of those processes so that human society can exist indefinitely within them. My thesis drew this definition from The Natural Step, a framework for sustainable conceptualizing and decision-making, originally developed in Sweden by a doctor, an oncologist, and used worldwide by organizations, businesses, and municipalities. Here's how The Natural Step outlines necessary and sufficient conditions to achieve sustainability. So, thinking about the cycles of nature within the biosphere, this symbiotic relationship of plants and animals, we get energy from the sun. It's an open system with respect to energy, but it's a closed system with respect to matter. That means that nothing ever disappears, that it is still here. There is no away. We may throw something away, but it goes somewhere. It goes to a landfill or something. Photosynthesis helps reorganize matter. And it does what sustainability scientists call pay the bills. That means that it helps us to move towards sustainability. There are, on top of this, or beneath this biosphere relationships, there are these slow geological cycles, volcanic eruptions and weathering, sedimentation, and so on. And human society exists within this. Sustainability is about human society to continue indefinitely within these natural cycles. But we influence these cycles in a negative way. This is how The Natural Step discusses that. We introduce relatively large flows of materials from the Earth's crust, specifically fossil fuels, heavy metals, and so on, introducing large quantities of those into our society. We also introduce persistent compounds that nature cannot break down. Thinking about, say, chemicals or plastics that cannot disintegrate. We also physically inhibit nature's ability to run its cycles, paving over wetlands, deforestation, desertification. We're inhibiting nature from doing its natural thing. And then finally, there are barriers to people meeting their basic needs worldwide. This is an interesting thing about the natural step, that it does not pit human well-being against environmental well-being, but it says sustainability means that people also need to be able to meet their basic needs. And so that is part of the definition of sustainability for the natural step. So these four circles here become four different sustainability principles. In a sustainable society, nature is not subject to systematically increasing concentrations of substances extracted from the Earth's crust, concentrations of substances that nature can't break down, that we're producing, chemicals and so on, and also the degradation of nature by physical means. And in that society, people are not subject to conditions that systematically undermine their capacity to meet their needs. So, this is kind of their, you know, large definition of sustainability. And we can think about these four principles in light of ministry, too. What might be some things that we could point to as assets, as positive things that we're trying to do to address the first one, having to do with fossil fuels? We as congregations might think about where our energy comes from. We might think about carpooling. Those help reduce, you know, fossil fuels and so on. We might think about the substances produced by society. Different congregations are thinking about the types of cleaning materials they are using in their janitorial practices. That would fit into the second category there. Or styrofoam use. The ubiquitous styrofoam coffee cup. There are other ways, there are other practices that congregations can introduce into their life together. Degradation by physical means. In our congregation, once we had some visitors from a companion synod in Russia, they looked at all the green grass and they said, "Why aren't you planting gardens in these places? Why aren't you growing vegetables?" It was just an innocent question because that's what they do there. But it made us think about the use of the space that is there. Can we use that differently than simply fertilized grass? And in that society, people are not subject to conditions that undermine the capacity to meet their needs. Social justice, social action can be part of that fourth category. And so we think about various things here. Food waste composting, bat houses. This was a group of individuals that built bat houses because the bats in that area were going to be losing habitat when trees were taken off the street. Or a greenhouse on church property, or community gardens, or solar panels. These kinds of examples help us begin to see implications for congregations' practices. Serving fair trade coffee also can be part of that. Advocating for social justice. Some of these things can be seen as steps to meet one or more of those system conditions in the natural step. Replacing a church furnace with a more efficient one. Recycling. These are some other options. The unsustainability of certain practices can also be understood more objectively when you have system conditions that are agreed upon, not only by, say, congregations, but municipalities like Whistler, British Columbia, and other cities. There's also a very nice, helpful resource, a series of short videos on YouTube called Sustainability Illustrated. And I can show a couple of those videos during the coffee break if anyone wants to see them, about 6 minutes long or so. And that can be a way to explain sustainability in your setting. Also within this framework, sustainability is not understood as where the concerns for the environment, the economy, and the society meet. It's not that sweet spot there on the left that's pointing to that center. But instead, that area would actually assume that there are other places. There are places that the economy exists independently from the society or the environment. And this conventional model is sometimes thought about as a definition or an illustration of sustainability. But that's a wrong assumption. We cannot have a place that the economy exists outside society or outside the environment. So this nesting circles model properly places those in relation to each other. The ecosphere is the location in which human society, and hence the church, does every aspect of ministry. In other words, all faith practices are done within the context of creation. And so that helps us to think, well, how do we do this in relationship to all creation, whether it's worship, education, building and grounds, advocacy, church life, and so on. So sustainability is one of these lenses through which to look at earth stewardship. And it has crossovers with businesses and municipalities. It can be a language we can talk to people with outside the church. Globalization is a second one. We live in a world that's increasingly connected and influenced by political, cultural, and economic forces. The effects of globalization have promoted international cooperation, cross-cultural understanding, and the emergence of a global consciousness, whereby people are looking beyond individual, tribal, and national concerns to the one world that we all share. But despite its benefits, globalization has also seen the development of a globally dominant economic paradigm called neoliberalism, which is characterized by privatization, deregulation, control of organized labor, and increasing power of multinational corporations. So the meaning and the impact of globalization represent different realities to different people, depending on their social location. Christianity has already played an important role in globalization, though some models of the church's worldwide mission based largely on the Great Commission have operated symbiotically with colonialization and paternalistic ideologies. As theologians Neil Olmerode and Shane Clifton observe, Christianity is not a spectator to globalization, but one of its agents. What is needed, they rightly suggest, is a critique of the way in which political, economic, and technological dimensions of globalization are giving rise to injustice, poverty, and environmental destruction, and an affirmation of how they can be reframed to reverse this problem. In Search of the Good Life, The Ethics of Globalization by Rebecca Todd Peters provides an excellent evaluation of four theories of globalization from a Christian feminist perspective. She concludes that the two dominant theories of globalization, neoliberalism and social development, are based on a capitalist model of industrialization that is environmentally unsustainable. Pursuing those two theories has privileged developed countries. It has favored experts rather than local community leaders. It has resulted in gross economic inequalities and placed a heavy burden on indigenous peoples and on the biosphere. However, she argues, a serious engagement of the two resistance theories of globalization, earthism and post-colonialism on the right, could help transform globalization's future toward a democratized understanding of power, caring for the planet, and the social well-being of all people. Earthist proponents challenge something called anthropocentrism that ignores human interdependence of all life and call for a future of smaller economies that prioritize a turn toward bioregionalism and cultivating local relationships between producers, excuse me, and consumers. Post-colonialists challenge the power of multinational corporations and reinterpret globalization as global solidarity, championing the awareness of human diversity and people's movements where strength is rooted in the autonomy and moral agency of the community. So how does globalization affect us in our congregations? Many congregations have global connections through companion synod relationships or global mission relationships, missionary support, and disaster relief. The concept of globalization invites congregations to consider how their own worldviews, actions and inactions, and resource consumption not only impact human society and their environment on a local level, but also have global consequences. The things that we do in our congregations not only affect us locally, but also on a global scale. Global civil society is another lens, and considering that realm, the realm of nonprofits and non-government organizations, also helps cultivate an integrated approach to congregational earth stewardship. First, it points to environmental organizations that could be potential partners for congregations in caring for creation. Second, it also describes how some secular institutions categorize religious organizations and describe their services to the community as part of civil society. When social scientists look at the church, they say, churches are also part of civil society. We might say churches can be reduced to civil society organizations. We are created by the Holy Spirit, body of Christ, people of God. But we can learn from what some people say about civil society. And the Center for Civil Society Studies at Johns Hopkins is one example of a group that has provided notable leadership in researching the interplay of government, business, and civil society organizations to address public problems. Since 1991, it's done a comparative nonprofit sector project that has collected data on the role of nonprofit organizations and their local significance. It lists several areas of ecological work by nonprofits, and we could name some of them. We could talk about the Sierra Club or the Wilderness Society. We could talk about Greenpeace. We could talk about some of these, maybe local, more on a regional or local level. The Friends of the Headwaters of the Mississippi, for example, or even Pheasants Forever. All kinds of civil society groups that are there, wildlife sanctuary groups, animal welfare groups. Such categories invite congregations now to imagine acting in cooperation with them in their local areas to create a more ecologically stable future. Such organizations might be happy to learn that the church is open to working with them. They might think, oh, the church is just about its own business over here. But what about if we invited someone from one of these nonprofits or from the local state park to come to our adult forums and to share about their expertise on wildlife or whatever? They might give the church a second look. And so there is some potential there. The Center for Civil Society Studies also lists congregations and associations of congregations as nonprofits. And it helps describe some of the things that they do for communities. Hypothesized contributions of nonprofits. They provide direct services. They lead innovation, they advocate, they express values, and they build communities. And we can see that churches are doing these things. But we might also say that churches could do some of these things in terms of ecological innovation. Putting a solar array on your church or at your community garden, being visible in such a way as to say, this is the future in which we need to grow. You become an example for others. There's a theologian from Luther Seminary, Mary Sue Dreyer, who utilized this framework to talk about congregations participating with God in civil society. And so she is one of these missional theologians, seeing civil society as an arena for the church's public participation with God. Gary Simpson is another one. Missional imagination for the church that reaches beyond itself to participate in what God may be doing in the world by collaborating with others. One congregation might not be doing a great deal in this area, but by finding other organizations in its community, you broaden the conversation and you bring in various voices that might not be already involved in your church. But then they might become more involved and they might think, oh, this is a church that cares about what I care about as a scientist and so on. By asking what God is up to in their local context as well as the world, congregations broaden the scope of their theology and practice. Many congregations already do so with civil society organizations that fight hunger, the local food shelf, the Second Harvest food bank or something. What about environmental issues? My research asked, to what extent do congregational leaders see nonprofits and NGOs in their areas as potential partners for caring for creation? And could they name one? So we've been looking at earth stewardship in terms of three theoretical perspectives. Sustainability frames the capacity of congregations to look critically at their own unsustainable patterns and demonstrate sustainable practices. And in an increasingly globalized world, congregations can be seen as partners with God in global civil society. As a segue from these lenses into practical ministry, consider these helpful images. The first from Larry Rasmussen. What suffice are not good ideas, critical though they be, but good community. In our case, anticipatory communities meeting adaptive challenges. Anticipatory communities are home places where it's possible to reimagine worlds and reorder possibilities, places where new or renewed practices give focus to an ecological, post-industrial way of life. Anticipating the kind of future we need to live into, and taking practical steps from theory to practice, implementing these things into our ministry. And these also from Craig Van Gelder, who sees the church as a demonstration plot. Do you know, when you go through an area that might be farming country or something, you see these signs up there. These are certain seeds or whatever. And this is like an experiment. That's how we can look at our churches, right? Hey, you know, we're just trying this. It's an experiment. We're going to implement food waste composting into our practice. We're going to just try a community garden and see if it works. We're an experiment. And when congregations feel the freedom to do that, it can open up all kinds of things. I want to share a brief story, and I want to hear some of your stories too. But a few years ago, a third grader came to me. We in our congregation had already introduced food waste composting into our practice. So that during coffee hour, there was a bin that you could put all the, you know, orange peels or banana peels or extra food waste, napkins, just like they do here at Holden. And we'd been doing that for some years. We already also gave out bags that people could do it at home. So a third grader came to me after school had started in September, and she said, at school, everything goes in the same place. And she started shaking her head like, this is not right. Because she's already started to live into that practice at church. And she said, well, what can we do? And I said, well, let's write a letter to the principal. So then we had a meeting with the principal, and then we discovered that there were other parents and children that were interested in this. They formed a green team at the school, and now they have integrated that into their lunchroom practices. And they've also started doing some other things with a butterfly garden across the street and so on. So you never know how some of these practices that you introduce at the congregational level can be like a demonstration plot, can be like a sign, foretaste, an instrument of God's mission in the world. It can inspire others to cooperation. So how are church leaders living this out? A few years ago, the Living Water Synod, that's a pseudonym for one of the ELCA synods, passed a resolution at its synod assembly that recognized creation care was integral to every faith practice. This was actually kind of a big resolution. I don't know for sure if everyone knew what they were saying with this. But it was to say creation care is integral to all faith practices. And it is part of our Christian vocation and our calling today. Given that synod's expressed emphasis on creation care, my research asked this question. How do leaders perceive and practice creation care in their congregations and in everyday life? And what is the missional character of their perceptions and practices? So, in order to investigate that question, I did a survey. It was an explanatory sequential mixed methods study. First, having this quantitative data from a survey, and then helping explain that, the data, through qualitative interviews. And so here's a little bit about the participants in that survey. 136 participants. There were 63% clergy and so on, fairly evenly split male-female. We had many more Democrats that were represented in that particular sample. They represented 84 congregations. 61% of congregations in the synod. And then I followed that up with 13 people who from four congregations, two congregations that had active creation care teams, and two that did not. So how Do leaders perceive and practice creation care in their congregations? You have a survey that you can take with you and fill out and see how your answers may compare with the ones that I'll share in these next. These are the last brief minutes here, and then I'll open it up for questions and for comments to hear from you. So some of the questions will come right off of exactly what you're looking at there. So how concerned, that's not coming up the best way to view it somehow. That's a little bit better. Unfortunately, that's not translating very well. How concerned are you about the following challenges facing the earth? Survey respondents tended to be very concerned about different challenges facing the earth, with over half of them being very concerned about most of the issues listed. The highest levels of concern had to do with climate change, water issues, and energy issues, with more than 90% of the respondents being concerned or very concerned about those challenges. Although other issues ranked lower in levels of concern, more than 75% of survey respondents were concerned about all issues listed. That's the first question that you have on your survey. Perceptions about society and creation care. In this next table, almost all respondents said they believe humanity's well-being is dependent on the Earth's well-being, 99%. More than 9 out of 10 have become concerned about the environment in recent years, and agree that there is overwhelming scientific evidence that the current use of Earth's resources is unsustainable. A vast majority of respondents agreed that global warming is real, 95%, and that it's accelerating through human activity. Fewer, but still a substantial majority of respondents would encourage the U.S. to cut carbon emissions for the sake of the global community. Potential allies. Respondents saw potential in their communities for collaborating on creation care with Native American groups, hunters and fishermen, and utility companies. And a slight majority, 50%, could name a nonprofit local organization that could be open to working with the church on creation care issues. But seen from another angle, half of the respondents either didn't know a nonprofit organization or could not name one. And a solid half of respondents were unaware of the degree of openness of their primary employers in their area to collaborate with the church. This kind of data suggests potential for exploring and forging and strengthening ties between congregations and community organizations on creation care. We can also look at this data through intervening variables. If you look at the top here, Democrat or leaning Democrat, Republican or leaning Republican, and when you see a bold number over on the right-hand side, that means that that is a statistically significant difference between those two populations. So by using inferential statistics, we can compare the means of two groups on specific questions. In this instance, those who self-identified as Democrat or Democratic-leaning had significantly higher levels of concern than did those who identified as Republican or Republican-leaning about climate change, loss of biodiversity, mining issues, forestry issues, and global population growth. There were also significant differences between those two groups as to their agreement on whether other problems of the world were more pressing, whether the added expenses in dealing with the problem are worth it, and whether elected leaders are moving fast enough to enforce stricter environmental policies. Similarly here, a significant difference in levels of agreement on whether the respondents' concern for the environment had increased. The reality of global warming and human impact on global warming. And also here, on levels of agreement regarding unsustainable resource use, the emphasis on the media and the environment, and whether the U.S. should cut carbon emissions. I tested other variables too, like clergy and lay. Here it's not surprising that clergy thought most faith practices were more important than lay respondents. But the level of importance for creation care was statistically the same. For gender, women disagreed significantly more strongly with these statements than did men. For age, younger respondents tended to agree that employers in their area would not be open to creation care ideas and were not as confident as their older counterparts were that the issue of creation care wasn't too divisive to bring up. But statistically significant differences were found most frequently according to political preference. So, the conclusions for today. Leaders in the Synod are concerned about several challenges facing the Earth, especially climate change, water issues, and energy issues. They overwhelmingly agreed that global warming is real, that it's accelerating through human activity, that scientific evidence convincingly shows the current use of Earth's resources is unsustainable, and that science will not find a solution to global warming that would enable us to continue our current rate of consumption, and that the U.S. should cut carbon emissions. I would expect this general concern to become more intense as awareness of local environmental issues and global ecological distress in the media increases. Whoops. And then, second is political preference is a major factor relative to creation care perceptions. The statistically significant differences this study found between perceptions about creation care and of those who identified as Democrat or Democratic leaning and those who identified as Republican or Republican leaning reflected larger national studies. I would expect political preference to be an important factor if a similar study was conducted in another part of the U.S. While survey respondents tended not to agree that bringing up creation care would be too divisive, interviewees mentioned that this is a politically charged issue, and it can be challenging for leaders in congregations. But part of the strength of doing such a survey and such interviews is that you can show this in a statistically acceptable manner, and that we're not just making generalizations, but you can point to a sample. So next time, we're going to look at Earth stewardship and the Missio Dei through the lens of biblical images, and we'll look at some more conclusions of the survey, including some differences between earthkeeping practices as individuals and earthkeeping practices as congregations. But for now, I want to open it up for questions and also anything that you'd like to share from your experience in congregations. Yes?
You brought up an awful lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Awful lot of stuff.
I know.
I'll just bring up a few things. First of all, our church, which happens to be Episcopal Church, okay, has institute a sun solar panel.
Yeah.
And it provides a lot of electricity for us.
Yeah.
So that's something we've done good.
Yep.
That's something our church has done. Our community, and I guess a lot of communities, have done away with plastic bags.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think a lot of communities. So it seems to me that a lot of things can be done if they don't affect some people personally, financially.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So you can do, well, for example, the wolves, they've introduced wolves. Well, so some people say, ranchers say, well, the wolves are attacking our cattle. Mm-hmm. You know, so they feel it's affecting them financially.
Yep.
That there's something there. anyhow, I'll give other people a chance to have their say.
So part of what you're saying is that, you know, once it starts affecting my pocketbook, is it worth the extra expense?
Right.
And that's, yeah, that's one of the...
They take fracking, for example.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, so now the U.S. has much gas, gas, more than we need.
Right.
So we're exporting some to Canada or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But some people say, well, fracking is not good. It's disturbing our water supply.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know.
So there are trade-offs.
There are trade-offs, you know.
That's
not
a trade-off. So, right. No, that's a very good observation. And so, you know, as congregations, then you can implement certain practices, but then it also kind of impels us to get involved in these larger issues and to wrestle with it. I mean, we basically realize that we can't escape, you know, we drive cars and so on. But we need to be involved in conversations that will move us beyond, you know, fossil fuel dependency, and so that's where the conversations with the government, advocacy, as well as nonprofits and action with them can help congregations make a greater impact.
Yeah.
Our church is in a strange situation. We're trying to get the diocese. We're Episcopalians too, and we're trying to get them to divest out of the oil and gas industry stuff, and yet we have our endowments in their in their overall umbrella, and they're making us money with our money invested in the wrong place. So we find ourselves in this stupid bind, and not sure whether we ought to yank our stuff out of the diocese little umbrella, which is making us money. So,
yeah.
it really gets to be complicated in a hurry.
It does. And I think that's one of the strengths of starting with a definition of sustainability like the Natural Step does, is to say, if we are going to be sustainable, these are the necessary and sufficient conditions that we need.
Yeah.
And then you start with that goal, and then you kind of do something, what the Natural Step calls back casting. You say, with that future in mind, what steps do we need to do to get there? Mm-hmm. You know, if someone says, I'd like to become a physician or something like that, then that's the end goal. And then, you know, you have to take certain courses and you have to get into certain programs, and then you get there. But when you think about the sustainable future, if we are to have a sustainable future, that's what helps, is to have a definition that all will agree on. And then you say, we can no longer have the systematic increase of these resources coming out of the Earth's crust.
Exactly.
That's what the strength, I think, of the Natural Step is that it helps define this in a way that more and more people can agree on. It's not the only definition of sustainability, but many people are using it.
Can I just say a few
more
things? it helps to take stock of how you got to where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when I was a kid, 90% of the people, in fact, where I live, most of the people smoked.
Right?
Somehow we've gotten to the condition where most people don't smoke. Right, or they stand outside of buildings, you know, in the rain and smoke outside there.
Right, or out at the basketball court.
Most people don't smoke. All right, that's one example. Another example is South Africa. South Africa, because of apartheid, was a very bad situation.
Yeah.
And somehow, I think possibly because where the stock market was invested, it put pressure on them, and they changed.
Right.
Somehow they changed.
Right. The divestment was a big part of that.
Yep.
But how did they get there? How did they do it?
They pulled the money out.
Well, using your smoking analogy, the thing that makes us so difficult is that we live on a planet that already has lung cancer. We're not in a position where we can prevent that lung cancer. Our planet is already cancerous.
Yep.
And the most renowned scientists around the world, in an ever-increasing chorus of voices, are saying there is nothing that we can do to make this planet, living on this planet, sustainable in the long run we only can do things that are going to affect us in the short run, because somebody as brilliant as Stephen Hawking has now said, we only have 100 years left that this planet is going to be inhabitable by human beings. And that unless we have another planet that we can escape to, we are all, I mean, we aren't, because we're going to be gone already, but humans and animals are going to perish from this planet.
It's too late.
So these are all great things to do, but I think it's important to realize the only thing that we humans have control over right now, we can either shorten that 100 years or 200 years or 500 years, whatever period that you believe in, or we can shorten it. And the scientists have said, a group that has kept track of this for many years, they have the minutes before midnight doomsday. Yep. The election of our current president, that group said, has actually moved that 1 minute closer to doomsday. So I hate to be a doomed person, but in the end, we are doomed on this planet. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, Bob Gore still thinks that we've got hope.
Another image of doomsday, it's to me, it's ironic. I shared ministry with a church in Windom, American Lutheran, and there was
Minnesota,
excuse me, Windom, Minnesota, Lutheran parish, and they had a partner parish in the rural area. Beautiful farmland, and within a matter of about 6 months to a year, wind turbines came up, and there was a huge wind farm along the landscape. But I'm driving along, and I'm thinking, you know what? That's beautiful, but you know what it looks like? It looks like someone on oxygen in a hospital. Sucking in air. You know what I mean? Whole notion that we're just looking for ways to sustain our life.
Yeah.
And that should not have to be. That's just a sad image of something good.
Mm-hmm. These are all interrelated and contextual. And churches need to become places where we can have conversations that, like Holden Village is envisioning this summer, beginning together. We need to become places of civil discourse. We need to be able to talk with neighbors. In that survey, I'm going to let you know, when I asked the question about, do you see these particular entities as potential allies in this conversation, I really want to see everyone say yes, and any of these are. Utility companies, you know, as well as, hunting and fishing conservation groups, because we're all in this together. We need to, you know, be able to sit down with mining companies or with, you know, like Holden has done here in this valley. We have this shared future, and we're maybe on oxygen support now, and, you know, we're on a terminal track, that is what you're saying, Larry. And so how do we live adaptively, you know, into this? How will we also, as congregations, give hope in the midst of a hopeless-seeming situation? And, maybe it is that those practices that say, this is how we're envisioning the future. This is what we're choosing to do. And there is, you know, the capacity for congregations to sort of practice abundant living in the midst of scarcity. Our companion synods do that. Honduras does that. I mean, suffering incredible violence and yet expressing such joy. How do they do that? You know, certainly we in this country are greater emitters, greater consumers, you know, in the levels. We need to become part of that global community.
I think in our society we have been taught progress is the goal, prosperity, you want bigger and better, you want more for your kids than we had, and we keep thinking...
Yep. More.
Yeah, exactly. So we, your chart about developing countries versus post-colonialism, how do we get to a different mindset?
Right.
Because once it comes down to the bottom dollar, when it hits the pocketbook, all of us are going to go... And it can't be that way.
No.
We have to be willing to say...
Right.
No.
Yeah, this chart.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a very good...
And we say justice for all, but do we really... Who includes all?
Who includes
it's
all?
It's us in this room, right?
Yeah. Right.
Not over in another country that's
sure.
not developed.
Or the rest of creation.
Or the rest of creation. Yeah.
Yes.
And so that eco-justice... So what she says is you know, some combination of those last two columns we need to embrace more fully. But we're really dependent on the first two. Larry.
There are many people of Nordic heritage, many within the Lutheran Church, and I would encourage people to read a book that I recently read called The Nordic Theory of Everything. It will make you sad that your ancestors left their native country.
Yeah, right. They're doing so many things now. Well, the Natural Step is a Swedish organization. It started in Sweden. It was an oncologist who said, my patients are sick, and I think it might be related to the environment. And then he started to get environmental folks and physicists and others together, and they came up over 20 years of thinking about these four sustainable principles. But
one thing that book explains is how we have such a different view of life here in the United States compared to the people in the Scandinavian countries. They concede that we're all in this boat together. What makes life better for you makes life better for me.
Right.
And we are so 180 degrees from that.
We tend to, our tendency is often toward rugged individualism.
And they are willing to pay taxes because they realize what I pay in taxes, not only do I benefit from those taxes, my society benefits from those taxes. And in that way, even though the benefits may be going to somebody else, I'm benefiting too in the long run by having a better society.
Right.
And we have just elected a man who believes totally opposite of that. So we are in one big mess.
Yeah. So churches, the makeup of churches then too, the diversity that may exist within churches is a strength.
Yes.
For the fabric of society to say, this is a demonstration plot. This is an anticipatory community. This is where we see the future before it happens. This is the kind of church that we need to be. And part of that can be sustainability.
This may segue into, I don't know what you're going to say next time, but Christ gives us freedom.
Yes.
To, we can break the law, but he saves us. I mean, because we have freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So your definition of, American definition of freedom is, I can do whatever I want.
Yeah. That's what, what neoliberalism
says. Which is where, we have been taught as Americans.
Yeah.
We're individuals, we're going to prosper, we're going to have progress, we have freedom to do what we want. And yet God gives us freedom,
right?
But we have freedom
responsibility
to serve,
along with that.
To serve others,
right?
Freedom to serve.
Yes, that's right. That's a very Lutheran thing. Luther's talked about the freedom of a Christian.
Yes, which is different than freedom.
Right.
That.
So I, it's already a little after 10, but thank you for being part of our conversation this morning. And I hope that you'll join us again.
David, do you have a bibliography?
Yeah, so I have... all of this is in my this book here.
Okay.
And there's a
woman who is a problem.
So, also, if anyone is going to be going to the Laudato Si one tomorrow, my dad is doing that one, and he has free handouts that you can take with you ahead of time if you want to see.